So this is continuing with Mills on 26 August 76. So we're looking at your first large survey, 1952, published, in which you define the Class 1 and Class 2 sources. And you were just telling me about this paragraph on page 271.
Yes. Where I had stated that for the purpose of compiling the list of sources in the subsequent analysis, a discrete source has been defined in terms of a particular kind of pattern produced on the pen recorder, etc. This indicates a sort of operational definition I've been forced to adopt because it was clear that we had different patterns on our two interferometers. They were, the wide-spaced interferometer in general didn't always have the same pattern as the close-spaced one. So obviously you were not dealing with a single point source all the time, mm-hmm. So one had to make an operational definition.
Right.
And this, I think, is a source of a lot of the disagreement between Cambridge and us, that they were not forced to a sort of definition by working at one spacing. They thought in terms of single discrete sources. The other thing, of course, was the beating patterns we got, which indicated resolution was a problem. So that, again, one separated this out in terms of what one of these parts of patterns, of periodic patterns on the recorder, and you defined each pattern as a discrete source. But I did want to make it quite clear in here,
yeah.
And I may not have made quite a sufficient emphasis that it was purely an operational definition.
Right, no, I can see that now that you point that out, indeed. Looking at towards the end of this same paper, you have a log N, log S in the middle of the paper, and then at the end you talk about whether, if they really are extragalactic, that they would be of great importance to cosmological theory. And you were telling me before about how you spend a lot of time. Could you just tell me about that again? Thank you.
Well, I'd have to have a quick glance through to see just what I did say then. It was a long time ago. But I think the point was we had a whole set of different observations. We had this isotropic weak sources, concentrated strong sources. We had some possibility of identifications with extragalactic objects. We had a possibility of identification with galactic objects. And these set a series of sort of constraints on the sort of theory which you could have.
Right.
And as I said, it took me a very long time to sort this all out in my own mind as to what was the permitted by the logic of the whole system.
And you said that you actually set up a logical flow diagram to reason this out?
Yes, I did. I had to use this one stage.
Do you think there'd be any hope of digging that out? That would be of great interest to see that.
I don't think so. I had a habit of, when I was thinking about things like this, scribbling them on bits of paper. It could be possibly in one of my old notebooks. I doubt it, though.
Yeah.
I probably just threw it away. Okay.
But anyway, the result of all this thinking was what would you say? You it looks like you're sort of leaning towards the idea that they're probably.
Yeah. I think I felt at that stage they were pretty certainly extragalactic objects, galaxies, in fact. There were no mention of or thought of quasars at that time.
Oh, sure.
And it was this that I felt I had to check this, and this was the. Lay behind the angular size interferometer, the radio link interferometer. This was a way of checking, really, whether we had lots of radio stars or whether they were all extended like galaxies.
Okay. Let's see, was there anything else you wanted to say about
that? No, I think that's probably...
Yeah, we discussed it yesterday. Mm. Now, going to this one where Mills 52, in which you have six sources with very accurate positions, I'm just looking at specific questions that I may have scribbled here sometime in the past. For instance, you refer to in the calibration and refraction effects. Now, when you say refraction, do you mean scintillation also, or do you just mean what we today would call tropospheric refraction, or is it tropospheric and ionospheric?
I was thinking definitely in terms of ionospheric refraction. In those days, at low frequency, you could practically ignore the tropospheric effects.
Okay. And scintillation, I think you used the term random refraction here. Well, you say the random errors due to refraction effects. That's what threw me. I think that is a systematic error.
Well, I see. No, I was thinking in terms of the results we'd obtained before, I'm sure, now looking back on it. In our Cygnus results, we had obtained apparently slow variations in amplitude, which we had attributed to refraction effects, and it was probably this I was thinking of here, that these could give apparently systematic changes in the amplitude of the interference pattern. And it wasn't clear to me that this may not be worse at wide spacings.
I see.
And this would depend on the model one had, I think, of the ionospheric irregularities.
So it really was a sort of a scintillation being called random refraction.
Yes,
because the sources jumping around.
I think that, I'm pretty sure that's what I meant.
Yeah,
at the time.
That's what I thought. I'd never seen that used that way. And here I've noted that you have corrected the position of Cygnus from Mills and Thomas. It was 3.5 seconds of time off, so.
Uh-huh.
Apparently, sometime in the meanwhile, you.
This was a re-measurement. This is the position of the actual galaxy, is it, moving?
No. Slightly wrong. This is the radio position.
Oh, yes, the nebula was slightly wrong, yes. Yeah.
And Fornax A, it turns out that the right ascension is a good bit off, and I just wanted to ask you if you can remember why that was.
It turns out to be six seconds.
55 seconds.
Yes, in fact, this prevented us making the identification of 1316, although we knew of the possibility of that identification for quite some time. In fact, I remember Bolton had noted a similarity between that and 5128, which he'd read of in the names of one of Shapley's papers. So we knew about the possibility of an identification of 1316, and this RA was rather surprising, because I was thinking that it would turn out as an identification. The reason is quite clear when you look at the distribution, and this sort of demonstrates the difficulty of dealing with interferometers when you have an extended source. Fornax A is a double source, and although the centroid is nicely on the galaxy, in fact the fine structure is more distributed on one side than the other, so that the position is weighted towards the position of the fine structure.
I see.
We know now what's happened, but at that time it wasn't clear.
You also mentioned in the paper that this is the weakest source investigated, which didn't help either.
Right? No, that's right. The pattern was not clear. There was a bit of confusion in the pattern to this.
Okay. Now, let's just take a look at this one on extended sources, and I guess we haven't talked about this at all, so maybe if you could tell me about this experiment, which you made some simple assumptions in order to get the
An extension of the work, of course, described in that earlier Nature paper, using the same instrument, and merely trying large numbers of different orientations and baselines.
The entire Fourier theory, I guess, was pretty apparent as to
that goes back to Pawsey and Painscott and MacReady, Pawsey,
right.
Oh, MacReady, Painscott, Pawsey.
I've
forgotten
that. That's right. Yeah, that paper. 47.
Yeah, it was basically Pawsey's idea. So we were very familiar with that.
Here's your portable equipment here.
Oh yes.
Was that still Army surplus stuff, or were you buying new stuff by that time?
We were making a lot of it. By then, so I can't really be sure. I don't think it was Army surplus by then.
Are there reasonable prints of these things that are still around at CSIRO?
I think it's probably likely there are, yes.
I'd like to get a hold of some of those.
Yeah.
Now, you have a figure here in which you compare photographs with what we today call radiographs of Centaurus, Virgo, and Taurus, and Virgo is a little bit confusing, I guess, because it's E0 or E1 or something, and you came out with elliptical thing.
This elliptical thing is now known as the halo of Virgo A.
Right. But Centaurus and Taurus really did have basically the shape of the galaxy.
Which was actually wrong in the case of Centaurus, right. Of course, because, again, by having insufficient spacing, I had missed the double nature of the central source.
Right.
And so that what I came out with was quite the wrong direction. It should have been going at right angles to my distribution.
To the one you had, yeah.
Yes.
But that was with only, three or four spacings that you were trying to make these models.
Yeah.
Once again.
Of course, there was no real indication then that one needed a lot of spacings to sort things out.
Right. Well, here they are here. It looks like you have, that's for Virgo, you have about 8. But let me ask again, here's Centaurus. Well, there are some interesting wiggles in Centaurus.
There are, yes, certainly. And what I had
noise,
missed...
actually,
what had been missed there was that the visibility function crossed over into the negative region. That if I had picked that, it would have made a completely different model.
But anyway...
But it did show that they, grossly speaking, the sizes were equivalent. And in fact, the shapes turned out quite well for Crab and for M87. Centaurus was missed.
Yeah. But let me ask you more explicitly about this Fourier theory, because it's of interest to me to know whether it was quite clear to you as you went around these various spacings and all, exactly what you were doing, and that you could, if you had enough time, that you could do the whole thing properly.
Oh, yes, that was known, but it wasn't considered to be technically feasible.
And why not?
Because of the phase problem. I mean, simply the amplitude information was only useful if one had a completely symmetrical system. And we didn't think it likely that we had that. We thought we had to have phase information if we were really going to plot things. So we didn't, I didn't think it was technically feasible to carry the phase information over large spacings and get high resolution.
Did you ever try it, actually?
Not really, no.
Okay, well, the next thing I come to here is the whole Mills cross, and you mentioned briefly yesterday how the idea came to you that you really felt you needed a pencil beam, but can you explicitly sort of say, well, still the cross and the phase-in-phase technique is not obvious at that time, I don't think.
No, it came out of our three-element survey. That's the one we were talking about earlier.
Right.
And there were two things came out there, I think. One was the...
That's three.
One was this difference in the responses of the of the close-spaced interferometer compared to the wide-spaced interferometer, which showed we had to have all Fourier components, as we now say. And the other thing was we saw that there was resolution problems because we had lots of beating patterns which showed that sources were not being observed individually. I think these were two of the important things. And on the technical thing which suggested to me the use of the cross was attempts to sort things out, sources out, when they were beating together by pointing our antennae in different directions so that we were getting the product of the two diagrams.
I see.
I was familiar with that at the time, and it's mentioned somewhere in the paper that we did this. And we used to put, for instance, a zero on one of the sources and to try and...
This was a radar technique also, was it at this time? Isn't that used to an object on the side lobe, or I mean on the side of a beam in order to, and switch back and forth?
Yes, that could have been it. I don't remember how it came about that I was using this, but I think I had simply noted that you could cut down the response of a source by putting one of the antennas near a minimum. And
that must be this remark, which indeed I was going to ask you about. A similar method of using the common portion of overlapping beams produce a narrower effective beam has already been used.
Yeah, that's right. That was what we were doing, and this really suggested it to me. I think Cambridge were also thinking of this sort of thing at the same time, obviously, because it came out later in a paper by Ryle.
Well, that was 52 also,
the same as... Yes,
Well, yours came out in 53, actually.
Well, this paper came out in 52. You see, we had been doing, playing with this sort of technique. And in fact, the whole idea of the cross was worked out in 52 sometime.
I wanted to ask you, did you know about Ryle's whole face switching thing while this was going on?
Yes, we knew of the face switching technique. This was used in our, in the survey, which we had done. In fact, it was mentioned there that I used a face switch similar to Ryle's. This was a survey done in 1950 and 1951.
Right.
So that was a great advance at the time, and we recognized that, and we did sort of went over entirely to the switch system. And so I got familiar with how it worked. And the things which appeared were that to do surveys you needed a pencil beam. And I spent a lot of time thinking of just large arrays, because it was also obvious that one needed high resolution. And then it did occur to me that you didn't need all the area of the arrays, because you were confusion limited. All those ideas sort of were worked out in around about 51, 52. I can't remember exactly when. And I can't remember precisely when the idea of cutting out most of the dipoles in an array and just using a cross part came to me, but that's how, in fact, I thought of it in terms of an array, and then of using these.
And then finally, it didn't need to be a filled thing.
Then I realized that that just having a cross and taking total power was useless because of the wide responses, and it sort of suddenly came to me, well, I can use the sort of technique I've already been using and just multiply one against the other. And that was sometime in 52, that idea came to me. So it didn't really come as the basis of an interferometer, thinking in terms of interferometers, but thinking in terms of pencil beams. And as I was quite convinced this is what was needed for survey work.
Just going back to this comment about using the common portion of overlapping beams, you say that it was used in the survey, Mills 52.
Yes.
Yet I don't think there's any mention in that
there
paper.
There is. I'm sure you'll find a mention there somewhere for sorting out beating patterns by pointing antennae in different directions.
Okay, I'll take a look at that afterwards. Then you built a model of this.
Yes.
I guess it wasn't clear that it really was going to work.
No, there was considerable internal criticism, let's say.
What was the nature of this?
I had to convince head of our laboratory, Bowen, that it was worth putting any money into.
But why wouldn't it be?
I don't know. he didn't believe it would work.
I see.
So I can't, for the life of me, now remember the argument used, but it was something to the effect that if you had two separate antennas, the null result, it must give a null result over the sky, so you'd have no, it wouldn't give any response at all, or something. But I can't really understand it. I couldn't at the time, but I had to get to work and build one.
And so you did, and I guess it worked famously.
Yes, very nicely.
And then came the business of trying to get the full thing built, and I guess you were able to convince Bowen then?
Oh, there's no doubt about it. After all, we observed the Magellanic Clouds for the first time with that small one.
With the small one, I see.
Yes, yeah.
Well, in fact, since you brought that up, was that publication?
I think it's just mentioned as a byproduct in this paper on the cross somewhere at the experimental model.
You have a thing of the sun here.
Yes.
And here's the one showing the first observations of the Magellanic Cloud.